Welcome to Faithful Economy, a podcast of the Association of Christian Economists. We host conversations about important economic and moral questions. I'm your host, Steve McMullen of Hope College. In this episode, I talk to Jordan Baller, a senior research fellow at the Acton Institute. We take a deep dive into the ways that theologians and economists tend to disagree. Our starting point is an essay that Baller wrote about the different interpretations of the word scarcity. We talk at length about the different starting assumptions that scholars work with, the differences in language, the difficulty separating facts from value judgments, and much more. The conversation is a bit specialized, but it's really important for understanding the foundational differences between economic thinking and theological thinking. This kind of work is really hard, and for those of us invested in it, conversation partners can be hard to find. I hope that this will serve as an accessible introduction to some of the thornier issues. Jordan is a historian and a theologian with a deep knowledge of the Reformation theologians, but his writing has covered many topics, including a fair bit of writing about economics and in collaboration with economists. For the last few years, he has been a postdoctoral fellow with the Moral Markets Project, which we talk about a bit near the end of the show. He is the author of 3 books, numerous articles and essays, and editor of a series of English translations of Abraham Kuyper's work. Before we get to the conversation, one other quick note. As of this week, I've made it possible for listeners to support the show financially through the podcast website at anchor.fm/faithfuleconomy. Fundraising is not the point of this show, but the Association of Christian Economists runs on a tight budget. Nobody gets paid for any of the work that we do. If you want to support the association, we would greatly appreciate it, and 100% of your donations would go toward our programming. Okay, with that, let's get to the conversation. Jordan Baller, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I invited you to talk to me today largely because you have a kind of unique window into the way that economists think and also the way that theologians and pastors think. You come out of a seminary background. You have a theology and a history background as a scholar, but you hang out with economists a lot and you write a lot about economics. And so I was quite intrigued when you picked up in a couple of things you've written recently, the subject of the dialogue between economists and theologians. This, of course, is a conversation that's near and dear to my heart. It's also one of the things that the Association of Christian Economists has focused on over the years. And so I wanted to dig into some of the details with you here today. So let's start with that nice essay that you just had come out earlier this year in volume 23 of the Journal of Markets and Morality. I'll link to it in the show notes so that our listeners can go and read the thing in its entirety. In this essay, you make a nice argument about how interdisciplinary work between economists and theologians is prone to all kinds of difficulty. Could you start by just summarizing that argument for us?
Yeah, so in that framing, and I think it's true too in the short piece, I do focus a little bit more on the negatives in the sense that there are a bunch of the obstacles, difficulties that we face. I don't want to have that overshadow the positive case or the positive possibilities and hope that we should be pursuing these kinds of conversations. So part of the reason I think paying attention to the difficulties is so important is because there's so much value to the conversation itself. So in that sense, I'm trying to make an argument against running aground and actually, you know, moving forward positively and constructively. In the context, and let me just say that the piece that I wrote is part of a larger symposium on economic method and this interdisciplinary dialogue, you could say. So it's within that context that I talk a little bit about essentially terminological difficulties. There are all kinds of words and terms that get used by either theologians primarily or economists primarily that the other side reads maybe in an essay and says, oh, I know what that means, and makes all kinds of assumptions or conclusions based on that. They're reading into what that term means for them. And so I have some general comments about that as a phenomenon. And then I talk about scarcity specifically in the second half of that essay. So yeah, I'm really trying to talk, in that case, make a positive argument for cross-disciplinary collaboration and the sensitivity to cross-disciplinary approaches, but do so in a way that is clearing some ground and trying to open things up. Part of this for me as a theologian is more personal than it is kind of theoretical. Like I see a lot of this come through in terms of disposition or attitude. Speaking again more, and this piece is more from the theological side, what do theologians do wrong in many cases when they're trying to engage with economics? I want to ask the question, does theology have anything to learn from economics? And your answer to that question is going to be really important for how you might engage or decide not to. And in that sense, theologians as a group probably have a revealed preference. There's not much engagement with theology with on the part of theologians for economics, and they don't think they have much to learn. More personally, do I as a theologian have anything to learn from an economist? So that's one reason I really value these kinds of conversations. In that sense, you as an economist and me as a theologian are instantiating part of this dialogue that's ongoing throughout history. So I really appreciate this opportunity. Positively speaking, I want to encourage a posture of humility that there may actually be something to learn on either side from one another.
That makes a lot of sense. I'd add, I think that the conversation that we have between economists and theologians is really just kind of a rarefied version of the same dialogue that happens in our churches, of course, when you have business people and professionals interacting with trained pastors. There is a vocabulary difference. Mm-hmm. While they might not have arguments about what it means to assume that scarcity is a fundamental part of creation, which I'm looking forward to talking about, nevertheless, this kind of vocabulary difference and this kind of sometimes ships passing in the night element sort of is a part of a big cultural divide between the world of commerce and the church. I think you'd probably agree with me that promoting some kind of productive conversation across those lines is important.
I agree with you in that sense that I do think this dialogue, the sort of scholarly academic level of dialogue between theology and economics, is part of a larger, not only discussion, but just lived reality of trying to bring the sacred and secular together in the kind of classical dualistic oppositional sense, right? Trying to find a holistic approach that does justice to our reality as material beings that need to eat and have shelter and sleep and love and do all these other kinds of things that we think of as more mundane, and then relate those properly to the kinds of things we tend to associate with church, which is our eternal destiny and salvation and spiritual goods. So right. In that sense, yeah, one way of thinking about the relationship between theology and economics is a kind of a body soul unity, something like that, something to be some reconciliation of those two things rather than a sharp opposition, which leads you into all kinds of, let's just say, problematic views and ways of living.
Yes, I get it. Hey, that's enough meta, I guess. We should actually have you talk about the disagreement that we're talking about. Let's dip into the conversation about scarcity in particular. Sure. And I think we can go broad again after that. Can you explain why there's a conflict or disagreement about how to use the word scarcity? How do economists use the term? How do theologians use the term? And what happens?
Let me just say, I think there are more or less technical ways of using the term for economists, obviously. Maybe we'll talk about those in a second. My basic point of departure was just what I think is a non-controversial sort of fundamental understanding what scarcity means for economists, and then how that, when a theologian reads that or hears that word, what the connotation is, not necessarily just what the dictionary entry would be for an economics dictionary or something like that. So, scarcity for economists really is talking about limitation. At one point, I offer a suggestion as to how theologians should read that word in terms of using the idea of translation between disciplines. So I suggest that when a theologian reads scarcity, they should think of finitude, right? That idea of finitude, that there's something finite that is being pointed to there by use of that term. By contrast, I think most theologians, maybe more humanistic kind of scholars, they read that term and it invokes all kinds of apocalyptic ideas of wastelands and scorched earth and deserts. I mean, the word scary is right there in scarcity. So it's a little bit of a scary kind of a term. And theologians, when they engage that term, tend to often, in many cases, cast it as a kind of an extreme reality. I cite a couple of figures explicitly in that piece. Walter Brueggemann, the renowned Old Testament scholar, makes a move that theologians tend to do when they engage this idea of scarcity, which is say, well, our God is a God of abundance, not a God of scarcity. Out of the fullness of the divine life and power, he's created all of this fruitful world. And, it's really a constricted and a worldview that leads to not just limitation, but actually to death, that embraces this idea of scarcity as a reality. So Brueggemann, in one essay, and this is a more popular essay, but I think it communicates a kind of a disposition, says, for example, that, he's providing kind of a biblical narrative of this contrast between abundance and scarcity, and says that Pharaoh introduces the principle of scarcity into the world economy, which is an interesting Yeah, for the first time in the Bible, he says, someone says, there's not enough, let's get everything.
No one did that before Pharaoh, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it sort of reminds me of debates about liberalism and individualism. Like, I think Adam had a pretty strong sense of himself, at least after the fall. And the same for Cain. They may not have had all the theoretical architecture of liberalism or individualism, but I think they had an idea of what they were, you know, what they wanted. Pretty clearly, Cain had a sense of scarcity with respect to Abel in terms of positional goods. So maybe that's something we could talk about later too, where scarcity might actually, you know, be really useful to realize there are limitations in terms of positions and what places that people can occupy. Anyway, this is one of the kind of grandiose claims that people make when trying to, I mean, there's a rhetorical edge to this too, obviously, right? I mean, Pharaoh's, there's nothing really good about him in the biblical narrative. And associating this idea with somebody like Pharaoh is pretty powerful, certainly for Christians or Christian intellectuals or theologians who are reading it. Like, this is a bad thing. We should stay away from it. D. Stephen Long, who has a long record of positive, I think in many ways helpful engagement between theology and economics, in one of his books talks about this scarcity as a fundamental economic assumption. He says it's embedded actually in the anthropology of economics, for which reason then it becomes actually a theology of scarcity, which I agree with the move there in the sense that our assumptions about the human person do have implications for our understanding of God. But he concludes theologians must deny this narrative of scarcity, for it forces our language and actions into the inevitable embrace of death. So that sounds pretty bad and something that we should avoid. You know, these are a little bit more at the theoretical level and the rhetorical level. In the meantime, I ran across a piece, and forgive me for being a little verbose here, but this one is pretty striking too. This is a piece at the Political Theology Network that the Political Theology Society posts, and I'll send you a link to that in case you want to link to it later. It's called Jesus and the Economics of Scarcity. And it's by Graciana Belousova, who's from Lithuania, and she grew up in the kind of post-communist transition in the former Soviet republics. And there's all kinds of things going on in this essay, as you might imagine, but she's talking about capitalism and neoliberalism and this sort of stuff. But basically, she's saying economics is all about this kind of scarcity, and it's a scarcity in a radical sense. So she says the deadliness of exploitative economics manifests in many ways. That winter, and she's talking about a winter of suffering, the winter of potatoes and sauerkraut, she calls it, a part of me died. Not literally, but figuratively. The part that died wanted to believe in this, that this order of the world may somehow be redeemed. It died when I watched my parents age 10 years in a matter of months as they fought to provide for me and my sisters. Part of me died when I watched the old ladies at street corners begging for change, succumbing to acute mental illness. Part of me died when I saw homeless people freezing to death. Part of me died when I saw those whom we consider to be the gods of wild capitalism now fallen from the business Olympus, taking their own lives. So there's a lot going on there in that passage, but I think it's obviously reminiscent of a time of great suffering and struggle that she experienced, given the images we're seeing around the world nowadays, but you know, especially here, say in the United States, scarcity is in some sense a reality that people are struggling with, depending what you mean by it, of course. In this sense, it's really existentially important for economics as a discipline, for theology as a discipline, for being a faithful disciple of Jesus to engage these evils that we see in the world. Yeah, those are sort of, I guess, from more theoretical or more biblical to more kind of real points of engagement between theologians and this idea of scarcity that I wanted to highlight.
It is important to note that economists do place scarcity as one of the two or three starting assumptions when we describe how to think like an economist in all intro textbooks. And so it sort of makes sense that theologians would look at this and say this is a central part of the way economists view the world, because it really is. And I think the story of Pharaoh is really instructive, because for an economist, that there's nothing special about that story with scarcity. But that is actually a great description of, I think, what theologians are often imagining when they hear the word scarcity, is that there isn't enough to go around, therefore I have to get mine, right? Mm. These two things go hand in hand. So it's this assumed world in which the only way we can get ahead is by stepping on other people or something. And this might, of course, there might be something in this conversation about the kind of assumptions you make about capitalism or a market order or right, something of the sort. We can leave that to the side most of the time. But the fact that economists assume that the world can be accurately described by scarcity, in the sense that we cannot always do everything that we want,
Right.
We can't always have everything we want. So I sometimes describe it as saying that there's, in the positive sense, there's more good in the world that we could do or that we want to do than we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
There's not enough resources to do all of the neat things. There's not enough time for us to do all of the good things that we would want to do, just because we are finite, because we're created and limited, which is the way you describe that. And that it sounds like is not what Brueggemann is talking about. Brueggemann's a smart guy. My guess is he wouldn't argue with that, but he does make the argument, and Long makes a similar argument. Milbank makes the argument. The scholar that you just mentioned is making a similar kind of argument as well. Starting out with an assumption of scarcity leads us immediately to think of ourselves in conflict with other people.
Right.
Is that fair?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things going on here. And I really appreciate that positive way of putting it that you had, which again, to me, seems like it should be non-controversial. So part of me has a problem understanding why theologians make the move that they do in this sense. And it must be, well, let me put it this way. I think they're over-determining what scarcity means for economists when they're reading it in many cases. So if they had simply read something like finitude or that we can't do all the good that we want to do because we're finite creatures, that to me would be a much better way for economists to engage, certainly the intro level, you know, econ textbook definition of scarcity or usages of scarcity. Now, of course, there may be contexts in which it's much more technical and has all of these other potential implications. So part of the question then goes to, does scarcity entail kind of a zero-sum reality, in which case it's a lot easier to see how everything has to be competitive or I win, you lose, you win, I lose kind of a worldview. You know, this is also sometimes called a theory of limited good. Basically by biblical theologians understood to be constitutive of the ancient world. This is the worldview that characterized the ancient world. And part of it makes sense. Like when you live in a world where people who are bigger, faster, and stronger can take what they want from the people who aren't as big and fast and strong, you know, at the individual level, but then, you know, our rulers are the people who are able to conquer and defend and get us as people all the stuff that we want from our neighbors. And that's how you get ahead in life. That's how you, you know, have glory for yourself and can enjoy these material goods. It makes some sense to think, well, maybe we ought to universalize out of that the only way to get ahead is by hurting somebody else, or the only good that happens is to the, you know, from the harm of one another. So that's where this language of exploitative economics comes in, or exploitation, extractive kinds of systems that arise out of it. So in that sense, critiquing those systems and that worldview, if that's what these theologians mean to do, I agree. I mean, I don't think there are contexts within which there is necessary competition in that sense, or there's scarcity in that sense. But I don't think that that's determinative or absolute. You can't absolutize that to all of human existence or all of creation, certainly in that sense. There is a sense in which mutually beneficial exchange can happen and that we can both be made better off by relationships with one another. So if scarcity means that strong sense of a war of all against all, then absolutely, I think we should be opposing it. But maybe there are certain kinds of economic ways of thinking that would emphasize that kind of struggle, but I don't think that that's representative of the mainstream of economic thought, certainly the modern era. And that maybe is one difference between, you know, the ancient worldview and the modern worldview, is that we move from a zero sum encompassing all of human interaction to, well, maybe there are these parts of our human interactions that are not characterized by a zero sum. And maybe we should see how big that area of social life can be.
And to be fair, theologians, if they study economics, they might be reading Malthus. They might be reading historical economists and hearing, when economists talk about scarcity, the echoes of arguments that famous economists have made, where the argument is, in Malthus's case, quite explicitly, that if people who are relatively poor become more wealthy, if the poor start to have higher standards of living, they will have more babies, that population growth will cause there to be shortages of food, and that will pose a check on the population and push people back into subsistence level living. He had a very dire, kind of grim picture of population dynamics that a lot of early classical economists accepted as a plausible argument, at least. Now, Malthus had a whole bunch of other directions he wanted to go with it, but one of the implications was we shouldn't help the poor. Poor relief would have this counterintuitive effect. So I want to try to figure out, like, I want to put this in the most charitable possible light for the theologians who I do think are probably misreading economists a lot of the time. And I think the best possible light is there is a history of economists making arguments that are using terms like scarcity in this manner and using them to justify arguments against help for the poor in particular.
Yeah, okay. So
is that fair?
I do think, yeah, I guess the only thing I would say there at a kind of a micro level is I wonder whether we could say that's a more Malthusian style of argumentation than attributing it to him so much directly. I mean, I'm thinking especially about the work that Ross Emmett has done on Malthus. I'm thinking about the way Malthus sometimes gets characterized in the history of economic thought and the questions about welfare economics and things like this. I don't think, and by the way, he was a clergyman. I don't think that Malthus didn't want to help the poor.
Okay. All right. I should be fair. So I've read Ross's work, and I heard him give the talk.
Yeah.
And you're right. Malthus did have sort of a Christian mission in mind about building civilization, and he wanted a whole bunch of what he called positive checks. We don't really have time to get into an argument about Malthus, but at the same time, he did also make arguments against sort of general poor relief in terms of giving them aid.
Yes.
Because he thought it would not work. For these
reasons. That sort of helping might actually hurt, you could say. From his perspective.
He was the first when helping hurts.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's part of a much larger conversation, obviously, including figures like Smith, but also Chalmers and others about what sort of policies are going to have the intended versus unintended consequences. So in that sense, I do think we should contextualize what's been popularized as the kind of Malthusian view. And not attribute to it a kind of, and maybe this is a way of getting into a question about positive and normative distinctions that actually, I think Malthus was motivated by, you could say, a kind of humanitarian concern. It's just that his reading of the facts led him to conclude that these sorts of policies would have these sorts of effects. And you could obviously disagree about his analysis without saying, oh, and this happens all the time on theologians' parts, that, oh, these economists don't care about the poor, or attributing motives to somebody that they're, you know, that they just want to, you know, defend entrenched interests, or their motivation is driven by loyalty to mammon rather than God or something like this. All kinds of moves get made based on what in many cases actually are just disagreement about the facts of the case and the consequences of a policy intervention of some kind or another.
I think that's right. And I bring up Malthus only because I think the specter of Malthus is lurking in the minds of people like Long and others who have studied the history of economic thought. I sense that argument is kind of going on behind the scenes when we start using different terms for scarcity.
Yeah, I think you're right. So if you think of scarcity in a zero-sum kind of a worldview, certainly Malthus is going to be one of the first names that pops up in a kind of...
Right.
Right. I think you're right about that.
Yeah. Let me pose this one more way, one more sort of avenue of disagreement between economists and theologians, which I think is also part of this conversation about scarcity. And I hear this in Long's work. Milbank is a little bit hard to parse, but I think he's going a similar direction when he sometimes talks about scarcity. But definitely, I think Old Testament scholars like Brueggemann go this direction. And that is that they're working from a pretty strong distinction between basic needs and overall preferences. Economists tend to not break these apart. We talk about preference satisfaction, and we assume that when people are acting rationally, independently, they have a whole range of preferences, and we talk about them all as one thing. Theologians and humanists in general, I would say, do make a pretty strong distinction. And so the result of this is when they say that God is a God of abundance, what I hear is something like, if we did things differently, people wouldn't be in need. That is, you can't use arguments about scarcity or, you know, economic systems or side effects or whatnot to get around my main moral point, and here I'm speaking for the theologian, which is that if we just organize things differently, if we were faithful to the laws in the Old Testament, then God says everybody will have enough to eat. Economists, of course, are not speaking to that question at all. But in fact, we don't even try, because we're not making any distinctions. So when we say that the world is a world of scarcity, one of the things that economists and textbooks will often write is something like, we have limited resources and unlimited wants. And that combination creates sort of a necessary world of scarcity. And the theologian comes back and says, we have limited resources, we have unlimited wants, but we have limited needs. So let's make a distinction and let's try to actually provide for everyone or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we can make progress in this kind of conversation by making a distinction between needs and wants? Or am I reading too much into this?
Well, I think so. Certainly from the point of the theologians, you're going to get a lot farther if economists are more sensitive to these kinds of distinctions. And the disposition of theologians to, it's not even like make a second order move. It's like immediately there's value judgments about these kinds of preferences that are
definitely, yeah,
that are treated as interchangeable, or there's not, you know, economists don't want to make a value judgment about one preference versus another or something like that.
Right.
Part of what's going on here is that the theologians are immediately bringing moral judgments about these kinds of calculations into it. There's a long history, an important history of talking about, you could call it a kind of hierarchy of goods. Perhaps one of the best places for prospects for bringing these two together into fruitful dialogue is welfare economics, because you do start talking about some of these kinds of questions. You know, in my reading of Abraham Kuyper, the 19th, early 20th century Reformed theologian and polymath, when he's talking about poverty, he invokes this idea of para-equality, which might be an interesting way of triangulating discussions about inequality versus, you know, on a kind of, and basically what he's talking about there, as far as I can tell, is exactly what you're talking about, which is everybody has a kind of basic right. You could use that kind of language to the common goods that God has created for everybody to be, to survive and to thrive to a certain extent. There's a rich tradition in Roman Catholic social teaching, as well as in welfare economics, to talk about not just kind of the basic needs in the sense of mere subsistence, but what does it take to be a participating and respected and respectable member of a society?
Yeah.
And in that sense, the standard does change, right? So we get hung up in these areas on discussions of inequality, partly by defining terms, partly by bringing into this discussion biases about what matters in terms of moral calculation. So economists will often say, I'm not bothered by absolute inequality.
Yeah.
Or by relative inequality, sorry. I'm not bothered by it, right? Which is itself a kind of moral judgment. I'm not going to worry about it, like, because I don't think it's that important, either maybe as an economic phenomenon, but certainly as a moral phenomenon. I just don't see the moral. Why are these theologians getting so worked up about this other thing when what we should be worrying about is absolute inequality and how many people are surviving on $2 a day or something like this? Well, I mean, that's a value judgment, and it colors how the, you know, the economist comes to the conversation. It's going to influence how the theologians respond when they hear that sort of dismissive, you know, and I don't think it's meant maliciously or anything like that, but it's a sort of a basic moral assumption that economists, many, have about these kinds of conversations. So in that sense, I do think this is one really great example of an area where there just needs to be a lot more sensitivity to where the other person is coming from when you enter these kinds of dialogues, and willingness to first of all, understand what they mean. And not immediately come in like theologians almost always tend to do and say, well, this is a basically amoral or actually an actively immoral perspective, and we can just sweep it away. And I'm going to come in with my theological insights, you know, hearkening back to the days of when it was the queen of the sciences, and tell you what's really what about how you ought to value things or something like that. That's part, you know, that goes back to the kind of posture of humility, or at least collegiality, that I think should characterize these kinds of discussions. Let me just say one more thing about that too. And I mean, you framed it in terms of limited goods and unlimited desires and things like that. And a middle term, like, well, actually, but there are limited needs that we have as finite created beings that are dependent and interdependent and all these kinds of things. Theologians will also say, maybe you should have limited desires.
That's
right?
True. There's a kind of virtue element.
Yeah, this gets into the question of virtue ethics and its relationship to economics and these sorts of things. And so that's a sort of move that I think economists could maybe at least be informed by. Like, yeah, you can assume from a theological perspective a fallen humanity that is going to not just have unlimited desires, but disordered desires. And they might desire a good thing in ways, you know, too much, or a good thing too little. Part of it goes to your anthropology, like to the extent economists just basically assume a set of preferences, don't ask where it comes from, don't ask how it's formed, don't ask how it might be changed. Part of the stuff that's interesting in behavioral economics and is adding a history, right, to these sorts of changes. But I mean, that's an angle that I think has a great deal of possibility in providing fruitful ground for discussion, because the theologians are assuming all of this historicity to how people are formed. And not just historicity, but a metaphysics of creation and fall and redemption and these sorts of things that can go in and inform. And so what might the preferences of a redeemed person look like as opposed to a fallen person? These sorts of questions. I think that's a really intriguing possibility for this kind of cross-disciplinary collaboration discussion.
Integrating some kind of element of virtue into economics, it's been It's been tried and it's hard. It's really hard. And there's so much of economic theory that really is built on the basic assumption that we need to respect people's preferences and that we can't compare them in normative ways. And even if that sounds weird, particularly from kind of a common sense perspective, of course, sometimes people want bad things and some people want good things. In our theoretical apparatus, at least, it's a very difficult problem to overcome. I do think I probably need to get someone like Andy Jungert on here to just attack that problem on its own.
Yeah, because I think it's so.
I think it's an interesting and important direction to go.
Well, and again, speaking from my perspective as a theologian, I mean, I think this question of virtue ethics and economics is really, more difficult than the typical kinds of conversations, but it's one that has, I think, a correspondingly great potential for fruitful dialogue. So that's an area that I'm really interested in exploring and reading in. Sugden and Bruni have a great article on virtue ethics and economics that's, I think, came out within the last 10 years or so. That is kind of, I think, a point of departure for this kind of discussion. So I'd recommend that. Let me just take a little digression here and try to frame things a little in terms of this dialogue between theology and economics a little more broadly. And I'm drawing here on Stephen Long, who outlines three basic approaches. One is that he describes as theology bending to economics, that is basically theologians accepting economics uncritically of whatever school, of whatever kind of mode of analysis, and then adding glosses to it, maybe of some kind. So there's scripture on top of it. You could see this in what you might consider conservative political or social approaches to economics. You could see it also, I think, in many ways of characterizing liberation theology. I mean, Gutierrez, I think at one point, at least this is an anecdote, somebody said something to him about his understanding of economics. He said, "I don't really understand economics. I was just working with the economics department was feeding me." And so basically accepting it uncritically. And I don't mean to say that that's just a feature of, say, liberation theology. It's definitely, it happens on the, what you might call the right too, the political right or something like that too. So that's one version. That's not very appealing, certainly as a theologian to me. Economists might like that if they don't ever get any hard questions from theologians and just get biblical support, but I don't think that's a very good relationship between the two. The second one he outlines is a division of labor, which can turn into that other one if there's not a critical dialogue. And then there's a third one, which he calls the remnant tradition, is basically the tradition of radical critique. So you could identify it with schools of thought like radical orthodoxy. McIntyre is one of the figures that comes up here. Certainly Long himself is in this tradition. And so it's interesting to think about these three approaches. My own view is something more like the division of labor, except with a stronger sense of needing to reconcile these two enterprises within a larger understanding of reality and truth. So I don't want to just say, oh, the economists can sit over there and they're faculty and I'm not going to worry about what they do. They're talking about a part of reality. I'm talking about a different part of reality in my department. And we don't really need to have any kinds of conversations. We can just leave it up to something else to bring those two together. So it's more like the division of labor with a stronger sense of reconciliation between the two in a more unified and coherent understanding of the curriculum or something like that. And let me just say too, as a theologian, I'm always on the lookout for people who have some training or at least sensitivity of the relationship between these two fields. So much of this, because it's so specialized, it really has to be done integratively and with the help of others, either in terms of reviewing or actually co-authoring things. That's a phenomenon, by the way, that's much more common in the social sciences than theology or the humanities, co-authoring works and things like that. So there's a great deal of potential there. I've done stuff with Victor Klar, an economist it's not exactly a division of labor. You know, he takes point on certain parts of the question. I take point on parts of the other, but then there's a reconciliation in terms of actually putting a coherent, hopefully a coherent end product together. So that's on a micro level, an example of the kind of phenomenon I'm thinking of. But you know, people like Mary Hirschfeld, who rehearses the Long's tripartite typology of these different approaches in her work. Paul Oslington is another person with, you know, advanced degrees and training in theology and economics. Brian Fickert, coming from a more mainstream economics background, but then as a Christian, thinking really hard and long and deeply about how a Christian anthropology might inform the anthropological assumptions behind models that economists, neoclassical economists work with. Now deceased, I wish I'd met him, but Paul Hain, I mean, his writing is, if anybody's asking me where'd I go for this dialogue, he's one of the first people I recommend because of this great sensitivity to both. And then, you know, against, and also somebody like Michael Novak, who on a more kind of popular level, but very thoughtful, is working to, you know, bring all, in a sense, all of social sciences, the insights from social science together with the insights of the humanities and theology and philosophy.
That's a great little verbal annotated bibliography there, Jordan, which is a great service. Those are all phenomenal scholars and they're doing great work, and they all have different approaches, but you know, part of the difficulty of doing any kind of work across two different languages, across two different disciplines, is that there's so many avenues to go down and so many ways to do it. But yeah, that's,
and there's a scarcity in terms of what we can do as individuals.
Totally. There's always more good that we want to do than we
that's
can.
Right.
Okay, so we've really run headlong into this problem of the fact value or the positive normative distinction, which is one of the big divides between humanists reading economics and also economists reading the work of other scholars about public policy questions and whatnot. There's this, I think, a basic philosophical difference in how we do scholarly work. Let's think about that a little bit. And partly I raise this, I think it goes nicely with our conversation already, in part because you run headlong into it in this short essay that you write in the Journal of Markets and Morality. In the piece you quote Ropke here, he says, for example, if you want to be steadfast in the struggle, it's high time to bethink ourselves of the ethical foundations of our own system. To this end, we need a combination of supreme moral sensitivity and economic knowledge. Economically ignorant moralism is as objectionable as morally callous economism. And that's a great quote, by the way. You know,
yep.
I mean, that's one that you can use over and over again. Do you think economists need to put aside their strong commitment, at least in practice or in ethos, of keeping positive, empirical, and theoreticals, what we would call objective or what we try to be fact-based analysis, apart from the normative, value, ethical, what we want the world to be like side of what we do? Is that distinction helpful?
I think, well, I'll give you the short answer and then I'll try to nuance it in a way that a scholar is going to expectedly do and hopefully not undermine what I affirmed in the short answer. So that, as a distinction, yes, I would say it's important to understand the distinction, to work with it. As a dichotomy, I don't think it works. So let me just say that. So it's also in many ways something to strive towards without ever realizing it, because of our fundamental subjectivity as human beings. There are really, really important, this is a very technical and important methodological question, not just for economics, but for all of modern science.
Yeah, that's true.
I think it's important to not uncritically accept this distinction and employ it in such a way that you basically avoid all of the difficult questions of method and conscience that you, as a, not just an economist, but a human being, have to deal with. So there is a sense in which there are human activities that are more oriented towards description, as you see it, than primarily making value judgments. But it's more like a continuum than it is a kind of either or. So it's not the case that you ever actually have any activity that you have is value-free in an absolute metaphysical sense. Even deciding what to pay attention to is itself a kind of a moral activity.
Yeah.
So anything human beings do is moral in that sense, because we're moral creatures. So even the most basic, straightforward, empirical kind of empirically oriented kind of activity you can think of is going to have moral significance in that, maybe mundane, but in that sense at least. That said, it's not the case that you can just say, well, it's all subjective and value laden in the same way. So certain other kinds of activities are much more heavily oriented towards moralism or moralistically oriented. So one of the problems with a strong absolute kind of version of the positive normative distinction is that reality itself, certainly from a Christian perspective, is not value free. Assuming that it is, may have some limited methodological value in terms of being able to analyze some limited aspect, but then you have to be very careful about how you integrate that insight, that hypothetical insight, into the rest of your understanding of the world. We talked about Ropke a second ago. He's got, I think, a fantastic essay called A Value Judgment on Value Judgments, where he directly addresses this positive normative question. So let me recommend that. It was reprinted in the Journal of Markets and Morality, so you can find it there. I think it's open access now, so I can send along a link if you want to link to it. It's an essay, but one of the quotes from that is, the long and short of it, says Ropke, is that value judgments are to be classified according to their degree of subjectivity, which is tantamount to classifying them according to their vital and ultimate character. So this is another way of talking about, I think, something like the reality with which you're dealing as a, say, a scientist, the greater degree with it to the extent that it has an ultimate and vital character, the greater degree of inherent subjectivity there is to it. So another way of putting it is measuring the movement of a moon or a rock is not the same thing as measuring a human activity. And the more economists try to act like physicists, the less true to their subject matter they're going to be, because humans are different from rocks. It's not that we're totally, it's not that we're told, we don't share, we share some characteristics with them. Obviously we have physical, you know, so I don't mean to say that there aren't any physical aspects to, you know, human activity or anything like that, but we're much more than that, certainly from a Christian perspective. So, you know, it goes back to the old Aristotelian kind of, you tailor your method to the subject matter appropriately. And in that sense, it really is important for economics, since you're dealing with, again, from a Christian perspective, humanity created in the image of God, inherently moral and capable of all kinds of goods and evils, to tailor your method to that. As I said before, even deciding what to measure is, in a sense, value formed. So I don't know if it's Wicksteed, but it's that era of economist who says, well, you know, the economist's job is basically to tell you how to create wealth, not whether you should. Okay, that's one angle, but even concerning yourself with creating wealth is itself a kind of a moral enterprise. It has something, it implicit in that is, against this backdrop of scarcity, that we're doing one thing as opposed to other things. And that itself, you could say, well, they're all equally valuable in an objective sense, but actually choosing one communicates a preference, even in a, taken in its most mundane sense, that that has a moral characteristic to it. So I want theologians or economists to be sensitive to this. Part of it, I think, again, not being trained as an economist, just from my understanding of the way the discipline has been going, I would be, at least in the short term, more satisfied if there was more kind of philosophical and historical grounding of economics itself as a discipline. I don't think you have to just go to theologians to tell you about the morality of economics. It's there in your own discipline going back hundreds of years. So if there was more focus on the questions of method, the status of this science as a moral science versus a positive science, that would be great. The really intriguing story of the rise of economics as a modern discipline out of political economy, out of moral theology, really, in the early modern period. And so the history of economic thought is a great avenue for remoralizing economics in some sense, because you're going to encounter all kinds of people who's, you know, there's a sense in which part of what Adam Smith is doing is empirical. And there's a sense in which, very clearly, part of what Adam Smith is doing is normative. And it goes to genre and the importance of interpretation and all this kinds of stuff. But in the history of economic thought, that usually means going all the way back to Adam Smith. But even if you just went there, there's great resources for what you could call remoralizing economics.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And actually, I really appreciate the way you frame this, because there are multiple good things that we're aiming for as scholars. And one of them is certainly to treat the subject matter in the most appropriate manner possible. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to talk about providing food to children and ignore the fact that this is a morally good thing, for instance. And so we could be morally callous if we ignored that. In the same way, economists have a really strong commitment to a kind of professional objectivity. So I struggle with this question quite a bit. I've spent a good chunk of my career as a scholar so far trying to integrate philosophical and theological ethics with economics. And in doing that project, it means I've kind of taken a side on this debate. I think ethics belongs in the discipline of economics. But I also understand that for economists to speak with credibility on issues like tax policy, we have to have a set of norms and a set of methods for approaching questions, particularly empirical questions or theoretical questions about how a particular tax change would impact the economy. We have to have a way of approaching that that isn't committed too strongly to a particular ideological side, right? Because we do not want to be captured by the political debates. In an era with strong partisan divides, economists are doubly nervous and careful about our scholarship becoming just another partisan pitchfork to be thrown or to be used in a debate that we would like to usually be informing without being too close to the center of it. So I feel like that actually, so that's my internal struggle, but I think that's actually reflected kind of well in the way you put it, because you're driving to be a kind of objective scholar approaching your subject matter fairly, considering all things. That's in some sense what economists are trying to do when we try to separate facts and values.
Yeah.
But in doing so, we can inadvertently take philosophically and ethically subject or suspect positions if we pretend that a moral topic is not moral.
Yeah. Well, and I would take a step back and just say the attempt to do exactly what you were just describing as a discipline or as a society of economists in the broad sense is itself a kind of a moral enterprise. Why? Because doing the other thing you think is wrong, like it's going to be used. It's not just wrong in the sense it's going to have bad consequences. You think it's actually not a good way of doing science. And
right.
It's an error, but also in a sense, morally wrong to take the wrong model or take the wrong method and apply it, especially if you do so intentionally, because it has all these kinds of downstream effects. So it's like, it's wrong to be an economist who conflates ideology and the more empirical aspects of their work. So sometimes when I think about this and I teach the fact value distinction and its methodological application in positive normative distinction, I go to what I think is a great little video of Richard Feynman talking about the method of science, you know, and he says, basically you have a guess, which is the hypothesis is the $10 word version of that word. You have a guess, you make some predictions based on what you think about reality, and then you perform an experiment. And if the result doesn't line up, then it's wrong. It doesn't matter who you are, how fancy you are, how many PhDs or whatever. I mean, he has his own, you know, great way of doing it. I'm not doing justice to. He says it's wrong, right? If it doesn't line up with the experiment. So it's wrong in the sense it's incorrect, your prediction or your theory or whatever. But I think it's wrong in a moral sense, actually, to think for him that you know anything about reality if it doesn't correspond to this method. And that's where we start to run aground into, right, again, headlong into this question of the limits of the positive normative distinction. And I think there is a place for something like the distinction, as long as it's not put too absolutely and too strongly and with sensitivity to all these other normative dimensions that infuse all of reality. I think you could say, maybe in terms of motivation, we want to look at child welfare, or in a slaveholding society, we really are concerned about the economics of slavery, not in the abstract, but because this is a feature of our society at this time. And in a sense, this maybe speaks to the preferences of economists deciding to look at the economics of billionaires and, you know, their 10th boat, maybe interesting as an economic phenomena, but maybe doesn't have the same kind of moral significance that, you know, given a certain context, that looking at the economics of slavery or the political economy of slavery would in a different context. So there is a sense in which you're making a moral judgment when you decide to look at one thing and not the other, or to measure one thing and not the other. I would just advise economists to be sensitive to that reality, that there are trade-offs and there's a kind of a moral underlying reality there that informs that. And let me just say that again, to harken back to what I was saying earlier, like to not look at your own history, I think does economics a disservice in terms of a question like slavery and abolition. I mean, talking about Smith and others, I mean, that era of classical political economy has a great legacy for advancing human welfare. And it's cast as the dismal science in many cases because of its supposed concern for all of these marginalized people. So there's a great humanistic legacy in that sense in economics as a profession that economists would do themselves a service to be more familiar with.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here.
Well, and you don't need to come to theologians like me to tell you this, right? So here's a nice quote from James Haltman and Ed Knoll from their book Reckoning with Markets. Okay, which does go directly at some of this positive normative distinction. It goes exactly to your question too about maintaining this level of objectivity and standing within society and authority within society. And they say, as economists know perfectly well, facts, in quotes, have a prestige that our society that values, in quotes, do not possess. And the claim to be a, quote, mere custodian of the facts is the economist's own form of moral superiority, or they use this great phrase, arrogant humility. So, you know, I would just encourage people who are listening and want to explore more. Yeah, it's great to read some theologians and certainly people from the history of economic thought who were more integrative in terms of the morality and markets and these kinds of questions. But listen to your own brethren on the questions of positivity and normativity. You mentioned Andy Jungert earlier too. So these are some of the figures, as well as Mary Hirschfeld and others, who I think have a lot of, can't say they don't know economics, or they're a theologian who's, you know, misreading scarcity and therefore you don't have to pay attention to them because they're not being careful readers. There's some resources from within your own discipline too.
It's true. And, you know, we've had people writing about positive and normative distinction, these kind of methodological questions for decades, just in the journal Faith and Economics, right? Yeah. Which hasn't been around that long. And you can go back even further, right? There's been debates about methodological positivism going back a long time in philosophy of science. So this is a big conversation, and we're just talking mm-hmm. about a small instantiation of it. But it's a really important sticking point, I think, for economists and for humanists when they start talking to each other, is figuring out that this tension and this commitment by the profession has real implications for what we talk about and how we talk about it.
Well, there's a sense in which, yeah, these questions are perennial, and that doesn't mean that we get exhausted by them and don't want to think about them anymore. Like, to me, they're foundational questions for the discipline itself that have to be constantly revisited, and to some extent, every economist has to reckon with. To use that language again from Haltman and Noel. So yeah, to be a responsible economist, you have to in some sense know the issues at some level and decide. And deciding they're not important is a decision. It's coming down on one side or the other.
Hey, let's end that part of the conversation. Sure. Because I want to have you talk a little bit about what you're doing. Normally at this point in the podcast, I finish up by asking my economist guests what they think the relationship between Christianity and the economics discipline should be, or how they integrate it in practice in their own professional work. And, you know, people have different approaches and different views, and you've actually talked about that nicely already. I'm not going to ask you that question because we've been talking about it for an hour now. So instead, I'm going to use this moment to ask you about this project that you've been working on, the Moral Markets Project, now for a little over 3 years. It's coming to a close, perhaps.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And so now's a great time to look back and say a little bit to our audience, I think, who'll be very interested in what you guys have been working on, what you did for the project and what we should look for.
Yeah, thanks. So the short name of the project is Moral Markets. More details can be found at moralmarkets.org. And it's a 3+ year research project. There are 10 different sub-projects, and they range from the really highly empirical, sort of more mainstream economic methods of analysis, say the World Value Survey and things like that, questions that may be moral questions about virtues and stuff in different societies, but are using more mainstream economic techniques, to the more historical and constructive kinds of sub-projects. So I was a postdoctoral researcher working on two of those sub-projects. One of those is on Adam Smith and his intellectual context, specifically this kind of Scottish Presbyterian, more broadly Reformation and Christian backgrounds of Smith's thought. You know, there's a lot on Smith. There's a lot on Smith in the literature of intellectual history and history of economic thought. And yet there are still some things to explore with respect to Smith's own formation and his context that we thought was really worthy of exploring. So one of the outputs for that will be a volume on theology, morality, and Smith that's under contract with Routledge. And so we're working on finishing that. And then there's other outputs like articles and more popular kinds of writings too for each of these projects. The second one is sort of inspired by Max Weber. So this year was the 100th anniversary of Weber's passing in 1920. Weber, obviously, you know, most famous for the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, but he also had within that context, sort of world religions, you could call it, approach to economic ethics, which he was a massive project he left unfinished. And the point of departure for this project was really asking a sort of Weberian types of questions without, you know, his methodology. So now 100 years on, what do different global traditions of religion and ultimate value have to say about markets and economics and globalization and these sorts of questions? So we had a conference that a symposium that we facilitated. There'll be a book that comes out of that, working with many of the major traditions that Weber was focusing on, and then a subsequent kind of concluding conference that's still yet to be scheduled. And maybe that's going to end up being virtual now. So, you know, working on those two projects over these years, it was great for me to learn more about Smith and to read more of Smith and get into much more of the secondary literature. I just started to publish a little bit on Smith myself. I wouldn't consider myself a Smith expert by any sense, but reading him as a theologian, I found a lot of value in that, especially in TMS. It's a great work, and there's a lot to learn. And I do think it's important for people who are not just economists to read these sorts of figures who themselves were not simply economists in the modern technical sense of the term, but were drawing on the whole vast field of learning at the time. Their insights, and a lot of it's, you know, there are great philosophers who've been reading Smith, and he's underappreciated, I think, as a moral philosopher, not just as an economist.
Yeah. That's excellent. That's a great pitch. We can include a link in the show notes so you can go find the Moral Markets Project, and I'll also include a link to someplace where we can find your work, Jordan. Jordan. Is there some place that people should look in particular? Are you active on social media? Would you say, follow me on Twitter or Facebook? Or should we just Google your name? Where, if people want more Jordan Bauer, yeah, where would they go?
Well, I'm trying to think of how Adam Smith would answer this question, but I definitely want to be seen. I want to be seen. So I am on Twitter at Jordan Bauer. I have an academia.edu page that I'll give you the link to, and there's a lot of my stuff posted there that you can access. So those would be one more on the kind of publication side, and then the other on the, if you want to see my witticisms or attempts at humor on Twitter, I'm there too.
All right. Thanks so much for this great conversation. And I look forward to seeing you when the pandemic is done in person over a drink.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
That is our show for today. Again, I am Stephen McMullen of Hope College and editor of the journal Faith and Economics. If you have any comments or questions, I would love to hear from you. You can always email me at podcast@christianeconomist.org. Remember to subscribe or follow us so you can see new episodes as we release them, and to rate us on Apple Podcasts so that other people can find this show. For those interested in supporting the show, we welcome monetary donations. Just go to anchor.fm/faithfuleconomy and click on the button that says support. 100% of donations go toward the programming of the Association of Christian Economists. No one associated with ACE is paid a dime, and donations are all tax deductible. Faithful Economy is a program of the Association of Christian Economists and the journal Faith and Economics. You can find out more about the association and the journal at christianeconomists.org, and you can follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn.